Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of our Canberra podcast, where we chat all things related to RC sailplanes with prominent pilots, designers, event organizers, and other awesome guests. So Canberra Up is now available in several different formats, so you can tune in however you want. We'll continue to have these full-length video podcasts available on our YouTube channel, Armsoar, and it's available in audio form through Spotify and Apple Podcasts, so you can listen to it when you're at the gym, riding your bike, or you know, driving to work. Just search for Canberra Up. Now, let us know in the comments below how you're consuming this content so we can continue to plan and improve the channel. In this week's episode of Canberra Up, I'm super excited to have with us Toby Herrera, aka The Gorilla. Welcome, Toby.
Hey, what's up, man?
Not bad. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, what, 3.5 weeks since the dreaded corruption of our original podcast.
Let's not even talk about it. So we've actually, you know, we filmed one podcast earlier, as Toby said, about a month ago. Actually, I think it's been more than a month. I think it's like a month and a half or something. And then I corrupted the file and I haven't done another podcast since then. So
it was such a good interview.
No, I feel like such a complete failure. But anyway, we're back. And let's get today started. So for those who don't know Toby, he is the first person to launch a DLG to 300 feet. He's won the International Hand-Launch Glider Festival. He's won the USA team selection twice and has represented the US at the World Championships. And you are the bronze medalist at the 2019 World F3K World Championships.
Ooh, I have it right here. Let's
see. There you go. There you go. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself for those who don't know you?
Toby Herrera. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I've been flying gliders since I was 7 years old. And the bug bit me early. I got into competition soaring roughly about 7.5-8 years ago and fell in love with it. Been doing it ever since. It's for those of you that are contest pilots or just enthusiasts, and you've been to your first contest, your second one, I think you kind of understand how you take it all in with the community and flying sailplanes. And, you know, you're in the heat of the battle and you come real close to making a flyoff or making a podium and you just want to keep going back for more.
Yeah, and keep improving and keep fighting, right? And it's great because you get that whole, you're all these brothers who you would always compete against and you're always striving to beat each other and talk crap at the field. It's just a lot of fun.
You know, that's the best part about it. It's, I mean, the flying is fun, obviously, but after flying, when we're, you know, barbecuing burgers or steaks and cracking some cold beers and the shit talking starts or the crap talking, whatever, that's when it gets real fun. And then you're lucky enough to meet a guy named Gavin Trussell and the Truffle Pig. And then you understand that your crap talking isn't actually at college
level. Yeah, no, he has that at a whole other level.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I work every day to kind of keep at the top of my game just in case Gavin calls.
So how did you first get started in DLG? So you started sailplanes when you were 7, 8, and you didn't go into DLGs directly, right?
No, not right away. I started with a Carl Goldberg kit called the Gentlelady. Flew that for a couple of years, or should I say crashed it multiple times over the course of a couple of years. I was lucky enough to have a club here in Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Soaring Association. And at that time, they were flying a lot of F3B and kind of got tagged along with them. And they kind of turned me into a winch chute chaser. So they pay for me to eat breakfast. I'd go out about 30 miles to Sod Farm and I'd spend all day running down the chutes and bringing it back for them. And they'd reward me at the end of the season by buying me an open class sailplane. I want to say it was one of the models from Northeast Sailplanes back in that day. So the competition side of it, I was kind of introduced to it pretty early on, but it wasn't until I got out of college and I think I was about 30 years old. I got into DLG's local pilot gave me a Polaris. And I was hooked the second I threw it. And I had no idea I could throw the plane as high as I was until he saw me a couple weeks later. And I said, hey, is this good? Can I compete throwing it this high? He says, screw you. I don't even want to talk to you. I don't want to tell you. So I was like, okay, I might have a shot at this stuff.
Oh man. So I meant you're talking about launch height, and I mentioned this earlier. So you're the first person to hit 300 feet, and that is ridiculously high. So even today, I'm actually not really aware of anyone else hitting that. Did you set that as a goal when you were, you know, when you were launching or practicing, or did that just kind of come?
You know, not initially. When the whole thing started, this guy Adrian out of Utah designed this Bluetooth open altimeter, and it came out right when I came into the game. So I was fortunate to have altitude measuring equipment that could tell me. But for the longest time, you know, I was throwing airplanes, and I'm like, I think that's really high. And people would tell me, no, there's this knuckle dragging German named Rollo Sommer in Germany that will throws 50 feet higher than you. So I never met Rollo at that point. I was like, okay, I just want to keep trying to throw higher and higher and higher. And then once we put the Bluetooth open altimeter inside the plane, I was like, okay, that's 250. Let's see if we can go for 260, 270. And people said, you'll never hit 300. And, you know, I had tension headaches in the back of my neck for weeks at a time because I had to go outside my house in the evening when I got off work and just go huck a snipe as hard as I could. And, you know, you hit 290 and then 292, and then you regress back to 285. And then one day I hit 300 and was like, wow, okay, that's an achievement. And then the Europeans kind of chatted me up on RC groups and were like, oh, but it's not 100 meters unless you hit 100 meters. So I was like, you kidding me? So then the goal was to hit 100 meters, which I did about 2.5 years ago. And conditions were absolutely perfect for it, obviously. But I still invite any of you in the best conditions possible that aren't on a slope, grab an airplane, throw it as hard as you can. And the gorilla killer is coming. I know he's out there. He just hasn't been given a DLG yet. Someone's going to hit 105, 110. It's going to happen.
There's a couple guys who launch really hard out of Europe. Even in the States, I think there's one or two others who hit really hard. Oh, but yeah, I haven't heard of anyone else hitting 300 feet yet, at least not to my recollection.
I think there's a kid in Germany. I can't remember his name. He hit somewhere around 295 feet-wise. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 94 meters or something like that. But it was close. It's going to happen. And it's awesome because, I mean, you've been in this game as long as maybe a little longer than I have. And I mean, you being a model creator and a distributor, you've seen the evolution of these airplanes were and what they are now.
And they're leading more and more toward launch height, especially like our planes. We, and I know others as well, launch height has become such an important part of the whole competition scene because it gives you so much easier access to air. So I think with the advancement of airframes, you know, more athletic pilots coming in. I think it's sooner or later we're going to hit another 300.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm lucky and blessed that I came into the game when I did, because if I had come in back in like the Nighthawk days and the Kevlar airframes, I probably wouldn't be flying F3K because I would have blown up so many models. I would have gotten frustrated.
You would have been frustrated.
Oh, yeah. So it was a perfect timing when I decided to step in, and
the Snipe was a killer model. I mean, it still is. I say was, but it still is. And it was like the first one where the launch height completely like advanced way beyond the pack.
Yeah, I mean the way it launched straight, it had a huge rudder on it, and you could get that thing just to snap vertical right out of your hand. And I mean, you watch it go up and you're kind of counting in your head and you're like, that was like 4 seconds of climb. That's got to be.
Yeah, it's like, yo, it should have lost momentum by now, but it's still going and going and going.
You know, there's guys out there that are still flying, you know, 6-year-old snipes in contests and doing well with it. I mean, it was
a good airframe.
It kind of defined an area of F3K similar to what I would say Concept Vortex is kind of doing now, or, you know, what Concepts won the world championships 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row. Most successful DLG. That's correct. That's the most any other model.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you have these models that just define those seasons of the sport. And it's just scary to me to think about what's coming next, because we've seen just the huge leaps. And I'm like, okay, is it Yoda? Is it V3? Is it something we don't even know about? There's people in Europe that are just, you know, learning how to do composite work. And
hey, Vortex 4,
Vortex 4. Yeah.
Yeah, Vortex 4. There's Flitz 3.
What's right? Armsor is on Vamp 2. Is there a Vamp 3 in the works?
I don't know. I have no idea. If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
I think you might know the guy to ask the right question, right?
Yeah, I have his number somewhere, but I don't think he'll tell me either. Well, you know, before we continue, if you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to hit like and subscribe so you don't miss our future episodes. It really does help our channel grow so we can continue to produce content like this for you and others in this awesome hobby. Thank you. Okay, so back to this discussion. So launching, you know, is one of the most fun aspects of DLGs for me, and it's something I strive to keep improving. What kind of launching tips do you have for our audience? And like, are there any exercises that you practice specifically for launching?
Not anything that's the magic sauce or the magic key that's going to unlock, 300-foot launch for everybody. But I kind of look at the launch of a DLG very similar to a golf swing. You know, I think all of us have stepped out on a golf course and everybody's got a different swing. They're all pretty ugly. Some guys can hit it really far with a real ugly swing, and some guys have a real pretty swing and they can't hit it anywhere. So, kind of a segue with that, I hit a golf ball a mile, and I played baseball in my youth and I played softball through my early adulthood. And I found that, going to batting cages or going to the golf range and just working on that explosiveness of swinging a golf club or swinging a softball bat, it helps build those muscles within your core. Those explosive muscles that allow you to clear the hips and then catch up with the shoulders as quickly as possible. And then you have, body frame mechanics where, I'm obviously a really big dude like Gavin, and you're a smaller frame guy.
I'm tiny.
Before COVID, yeah.
Okay, you got me there.
but some guys rotate really quick around a singular axis. Me, I like to get really wide, so I have a really wide step pattern, and it allows me to get lower and spring my body a little bit more. But I would say if you're trying to improve your launch height, definitely work on your core, work on your smoothness. And once you're throwing the plane really hard, it's really important to pay attention to your setup, because I was launching to 240 feet and I was going out real shallow. And someone told me, hey, if you get the plane to go straight vertical, you don't have to fight the wind no more. You're just going straight up. And I got the plane to snap out of my hand and instantly put 30 feet on my launch.
Yep.
So,
Well, who doesn't do that? Gavin doesn't do that. He doesn't have a launch preset.
Well, I've seen him blow up airplanes. It'd be scary if you got the plane to snap vertical.
Yeah. No, he doesn't believe in it, but I tell you, and you're absolutely correct, having a preset and going into zoom mode or whatever mode you use for minimum drag, it is going to get your plane higher. Okay. Gavin's wrong.
I mean, there's a reason why the Banff rudder is like this big.
And it was, yeah.
That way Gavin can throw the plane and it'll stay straight. But no, when it comes to launching, find out what works best for you. You got to have good mechanics. You got to have strength, and you got to have this harmony that, just like a golf swing, everything's got to meet up in the perfect position at the end. And it doesn't come naturally to some people, and to some people it's going to come a little easier than others. But just find your groove, find your style. It's like picking a DLG. There's a lot of yummy bubblegum balls in the machine right now, and they all taste really good. It's just find out what works best for you and roll with it.
Yep, that's correct. Well, obviously, you've done very well in F3K. You've won a lot of events in the States. As we mentioned, you represented the U.S. at the Worlds. So what was it like flying at the Worlds? And, along the same tangent, what are some differences between flying at the Worlds and flying in the States?
It's crazy. I mean, the Europeans have been doing it right for a long time. Not to say that we in the U.S. haven't, but they're similar to what the United States is in terms of the countries are so close together. And their level of competition has increased to a level where these guys, they go out and they beat up on each other week after week. So there's this strive for perfection is what it seems like. I mean, before COVID hit, you look at a European DLG contest, and the winner would have all thousands, and the guy below him would only be 1 point off because he dropped 1 second in 5-2s. So it's the bar is definitely raised, and I found that out when, you know, I went out to, well, China for the first time in 2015, flew with you guys out there, and then in Ukraine in 2017. And I mean, I walked in super confident thinking I was just going to slay. And I found out, wow, this stage is a little too big for me. And it was definitely some humble pie, but it was good for me because it showed me, you know, we can take the same top 12 guys in the world, throw them in a fly off 5 days in a row, and we're probably going to have a different champion each of those days. And it's just because they're that good. So it was really good to show myself that it's not necessarily how much skill you bring to the contest, but it's more of this strategic game of making sure that, you know, you can lose a contest in the first day, but you can't win it. So you have to kind of condition yourself to be like, all right, this is a marathon. We just have to make sure we don't make the big mistakes. And it's time to be aggressive.
You have to be very consistent. And the mental game is something, especially at the Worlds, because it's such a long contest, your mental game has to be there for a week versus the usual single day events in the States, or every once in a while you'll have the 2 day events in the States, but it's a much shorter attention span. And the long one, do you think the mental part of it was something that was challenging when you, for the first Worlds that you went to?
Oh man, for me, it was mental, it's physical. You're dealing with jet lag and trying to catch up on sleep, dealing with long hours in the field and moving your models in and out of the field because storms are coming through. There's spiritual elements to it because you're like, is this destiny for me to come here and fly at this level? I've been dreaming about this since I was a kid. Some of the heroes that I looked up to as a kid, I'm flying against them. You know, there's a health aspect of, you know, do I want to go out and have drinks with the guys after the fly?
Well, you don't want to ask me and Nick that question because we will go.
Yeah. I mean, dietary, you're in a different country and you don't know, you know, hey, should we just stick with cheeseburgers and pizza? And it seems like everywhere in Europe has some awesome ice cream shop at every corner of every street. So you're stopping getting gelato or ice cream. And
Don't do it.
I mean, it challenges you at every level of conditioning, you know, and everything has to come together in that one moment for the three rounds you fly each day. And it is what it is. It's like, it's the greatest test, and you ask to put yourself there, and then you get there and it's like, okay, well, I can either think about it or I can just go out and just be who I am, do what I do, and let the chips fall where they may. And that's kind of what I did.
And for some of the people who don't know, and I don't know if you know this, but there are some teams out of Europe that take this to another level entirely. This is like pro sports. They will have like physical therapists that would go with them to the Worlds for the team to do massages, therapy, things like that. I believe the Swedish team had their own chef who would go with them to prepare meals so that they were on top of their physical game, even at in another country at the event. Like, you know, it might not seem so, like, you would never really think of, at least I never really thought about this before I learned about that from these teams. Because, hey, to me, it's like, I understand it's a world championships, but we're still flying airplanes, like model airplanes, right? But it's taken very, very seriously in many countries. And so the Worlds, you will get teams that are very, very professional. And if you're not at that professional level, it can be very difficult to compete against them because the preparation is completely different. Right.
I think that makes sense now why you bring Nick Wu with you, because now he's your masseuse, he's your chef, wakes you up, pats your back.
He does everything. He's my caller, but he does everything except for time properly. So
I don't know if I'd even still be in this game flying DLG or whatever if Nick wasn't showing up at this contest.
Oh man, he brightens everyone's up lives up every day.
we need to get him to start showing up to a bunch of F5J contests in the States.
He's been flying F5J. Well, we're trying to get him to America, so we'll see what he can do. if he's able to come over here for work, then maybe you guys will see him more in the States for 3K and for 5J.
We'll check with the FBI and see if they'll allow him to step on U.S. soil.
I don't know. I think he has to pass some sort of background test first. I don't know if he'll pass or not.
He'll pass.
All right. So I'm just getting started in F5J. You mentioned F5J. And I hope to start entering more F5J competitions next year if we can travel more freely. So it's been very interesting for me to actually chat with others about the F5J experience. So what drew you to F5J to begin with?
I think, like I said, when I was younger, F3B was considered an open class airplane. I loved what they call the full house ship, you know, two flaps, two ailerons, rudder, elevator. So after flying F3K, my natural evolution was to F3J. And F3J for me was kind of a mixed bag just because there's so much work that goes into it. Just like with F3B, you got to haul out winches and line and turnarounds and measuring equipment and car batteries. And you're packing that stuff to drive 400 miles to a contest and hauling it out 2 days in a row and hauling it back in and charging batteries in hotel rooms. And I was just like, this is just way too much darn work. And, you know, once I hooked up with Dennis at DS Composites, it was once again, perfect timing. He dropped the Ultima One. And it kind of changed the game because it was like, okay, we're taking F3K technology in terms of a Roacell carbon wing, and we're lightening these F3J planes by 15, 20 ounces and putting a motor on them. And all you got to do is show up.
It was a game changer.
Oh yeah, complete game changer. It set the bar for the rest of the world, in my opinion, to kind of meet him at that performance level, at that low weight, and produce a model that everybody could affordably obtain and go out and compete with.
Yeah, I think because for those who don't know, F5J started and people were kind of just flying F3J, as Toby mentioned, F3J planes, sorry. And they were really heavy and not really optimized for the tasks at hand. So Ultima One, yeah, I think that, and it took a while for others to catch up. I can't even recall what's the second or third planes that came out after Ultima One kind of changed the scene. And there were a lot of doubters. There were a lot of people who had a lot of reserve on whether such light, you know, quote unquote fragile model, because 3J models were, you know, they're bulletproof. You could tow them on a winch, but 5J models, you can't. And I remember in the beginning, there were some planes that blew up just from diving too fast and then pulling up elevator because people didn't really know the limits of that yet. So it's really cool that Dennis was able to, you know, push through all these naysayers and really, really, really change the game and revolutionize the kind of models that are seen in 5J now. Now, talking back to you, do you think that your background in 3K helped with building your 5J career?
Oh, most definitely. And I think a lot of the prominent names in F5J currently are, you know, currently flying F3K or were very successful in F3K. And for me, it was a challenge because, I mean, a lot of people were like, oh, this guy's winning or doing really well because he's throwing the plane so high. And of course, we've got a great, if I could throw 280 feet, I could win a contest. So moving to F5J, I'm like, okay, well now, you know, it's flipped. And it's like, okay, who can launch the lowest, still get 10 minutes and then put the nose on the nail. And it was a great, you know, paradigm shift. It's in my own mind and mentality to prove to myself that, you know, okay, this is about air reading. This is about planning, knowing the field, and knowing thermal cycles when they come through, but also in risk management of knowing how to, you know, attack a field or competitors in a round and either put yourself in a position to win the round or not get completely destroyed.
Yeah, it's a very big change in thinking, I bet. So regarding F5J, what would you say are the three most important skills to have to be successful or to be a good F5J pilot?
I think the one skill that people don't really give enough attention to or credit for is you have to be a great builder. I mean, you can't win a contest if you can't finish a contest with your airplane because it's falling apart. And I mean, we've been in this long enough. We've seen various types of building skills, and we like to go look at other people's airplanes and pull off the nose cone. And sometimes it's just a spider web of wires and glue and crap in there. And I mean, the plane flies, but is it considered a competition ship? But it's definitely something that people don't think about, because you have to have decent building skills if you want to have planes that are going to be successful in a contest. Secondly, obviously, air reading. And air reading has just come so far just, you know, in the last 10 years, mainly in the last five, really. I mean, I remember watching, you know, Joe's video on Third Vector.
Yep.
I mean, this, I can't even give an exact date, but it has to have been 10, 12 years ago, maybe even longer. And I never really understood Third Vector. I kind of, you know, took the theory and was like, yeah, I could see how that works. But then once you, you know, use Third Vector at the field and you're able to basically pinpoint a thermal within a 20 degree section of sky, it's like cheating, because you're like, okay, I know the lift's got to be there somewhere. The only question is how far or close is it to me?
And you just got to connect with it.
You got to connect with it. I mean, there's a lot of pilots that fly downwind thermals, and that's the easiest way to find thermals is just chase the breeze downwind. But when you can use Third Vector to actually pinpoint a thermal upwind to you, it gives you a huge advantage, because now, you know, you're not starting your 10 or 15 minute round, you know, 200 meters downwind. You're starting to get 100 meters upwind, and now you can actually see your airplane at the 5 minute mark instead of come limping back looking for another thermal.
Yep. Upwind thermals are the absolute hardest to read. And it's something that I think takes a lot of time and effort to be able to do. And I would say it's a magnitude harder than downwind thermals. Downwind, you can still use Third Vector to find, you know, where it's going, because it's not, you know, it's not always exactly downwind, but you have so much more data because it's gone past you already, right? Whereas with upwind, you really have to be able to pick up those signs by sight very, very quickly. And you have to be able to commit to it as well. And yeah, that takes a lot of skill. And what's your third thing? What was the third thing you think?
I mean, the third thing is just knowing risk management, because I mean, everybody wants to be like Ariane, who just lit to like 10 meters for an entire contest.
Oh my God.
I mean, the guy's an alien. Shout out to you, Mr. Halilulucek. I mean, I'm like, do I even want to make the U.S. team to go fight in Europe against this guy? I mean, I'd rather
just get slaughtered.
I just want to buy an airplane ticket and just go watch him fly. I mean, that'd probably be a lot more fun. But I mean, you need to know when you need to go super aggressive and super low. And the evolution of FIJ was interesting coming from the very beginning to where it is now, because I started very early and I saw a lot of guys come in the mid cycle, and you see them go through these trends of, you know, they have 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 0, 225, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. I'm like, once these guys learn not to shoot themselves in the foot, they're going to be dangerous. But you need to do that, and you need to make those mistakes to learn, you know,
you got
to
find that limit.
You got to put a contest together. I mean, you're allowed to have, you know, one 400 point round, but after that, you need to know, I still need to be aggressive, but I can't completely take myself out of the contest, Gavin Trussell. But I love you, man. I wish I get to fly with Gavin more.
Oh dear. I love that he's not here to defend himself.
I think we're lucky, because we'd have to censor a lot of the stuff that he's saying.
That's true. That's true. And you know that next time I talk to him, he's gonna throw some punches at you as well now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gearing up right now. I just got through building an Ultima over the last 2 days. We have a contest here in Albuquerque this weekend. So we have probably about 30 pilots from California, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico. So I'm looking forward to that. This is the first time I'm legitimately getting to fly a decent-sized contest and probably close to a year.
Yeah, it's really thrown everything off.
Last year, lost my flu.
Now, you were mentioning, you know, launching low and working low level thermals. Obviously, it's a huge part of FIJ, and that's what separates the top tier pilots like Arian, you know, the last contest that was posted, 10 meter, 15 meter for the entire event. Now, in a competition, how do you decide how high to launch your model?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with the historics of the field, knowing the thermal cycles, the corridors that kind of form up on the field. But a lot of it also has to do with kind of situational awareness and knowing where you are in the contest at any given time. I'd love to launch 30 meters all the time, but sometimes you just need to stay conservative and just go to 100 meters and understand that the worst you're going to get is like a 970, as to where if you try and light the 45 or 50, you bring a, in golf terminology, you bring a double or triple bogey into play when par or bogey is good enough to get you through the contest. And, I mean, me personally, I'm a fan of attacking a contest from behind the leaders, because it's a lot easier for me to know exactly how aggressive I need to be to catch somebody, as opposed to, and we've, everyone who's been there at the top of the leaderboard on Sunday, and there's three guys below you that are 45 points between you and them, and you have no idea what you're going to do those last two rounds. You're like, I might need to go to 30, but if I go to 30 and they light, 50 meters higher than me in the last 2 seconds, I'm screwed. And I think you have a lot more aggressive tact to attack that person from behind rather than try and defend from the top. And that's just my own theory on how I fly a 5J. I mean, if you're Ariad, you just say, yeah, I'm just going to go out and not even turn the motor on and just launch 10 meters and take it out.
But he's on a different level. He's in his own little bubble. And yeah, we cannot compare to him right now.
I think it's awesome because, I mean, it's giving everybody some insight into what perfection looks like.
And well, not only that, he tries a lot of different techniques as well, right? Because like, for example, this last contest he was at, from what we've been told, he was spinning around, with power inside thermals at a low height, and then zooming after that 10 second read. And he was getting 10, 15 meters over what the read was after the zoom, even though there's 10 seconds. So he was able to use this new technique to conserve a lot of energy during that period and, read 10, 15 meters, but actually get 25, 30 meters in usable height. And I don't think anyone else has been doing that, at least to the same success rate as he has. Right? So pushing these boundaries.
It's impressive because I've seen those guys do it, and I've tried it myself. And I invite any of you to give it a shot. It's scary. Take your 4 meter airplane, throw it 10 feet off the ground, bank it at 85 degrees with full throttle, and just sit there like a cowboy on a bull in a rodeo, just holding back elevator while it's going. And I mean, it's you want to throttle down so bad. And then after you turn it off, you got to keep that nose level while you're still circling for 10 seconds and maintain that energy to be able to pop up another 15 or 20 feet or more. And I mean, there's a lot of skill that goes into it, but it's scary when you try it for the first time, for sure.
I bet you there's a lot of broken planes on his road to getting to that stage.
Well, and the whole time you're wondering, was I actually in the thermal to begin with? Because when I pop up out of this and it's not a thermal, I'm going to look like an idiot.
You're screwed.
45 seconds. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what separates him then from all the other people who try to use it, but don't get the same kind of success rate as he has. Right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd love to go out there. Oh, go ahead.
Just go ahead. Cause I had another question.
I was going to say, I'd love to get out there and fly against him. I was lucky enough to fly against him at the F3K Worlds in Budapest. And I think that was his first go at a F3K World Championships. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's on the podium in the next cycle. I mean, he might as well. I mean, he'll be holding the F3J gold medal, F5J gold medal. And if he wins the next World Championship for F3K, he'll have the triple crown.
Man, that's a dream.
That's
insane. So I was just going to ask, so in ideal conditions, what kind of launch height would you be aiming for?
I think if you want to be super competitive, I think 35 meters is something that you need to be able to negotiate, similar to a DLG launch. If you're launching to you know, 150 feet, 170 feet, mm-hmm. you're giving yourselves about three mistakes worth. Of course, that it's different if you're in the wind, but in ideal conditions, 35 meters gives you the option to explore your first read. If it's not there, you have just enough height to get back to the pack. And, you know, I have a saying that I tell people I'm timing for. I say, don't go cowboy on me, because mm-hmm. you need to be able to explore your read, but you also need to have the ability to get back to the pack if you're completely wrong. And you need to have enough launch altitude to be able to do both of those things. And I think 35 to 40 meters is typically good enough if it's a light, calm, wind day, and, you know, there's good thermals popping off.
That's a really good advice. Now, there are a lot of FFG models available on the market now, and more are coming out every year. So you're a DS Composite sponsored pilot. Let's talk equipment a little bit. So what model are you flying right now?
Currently flying the Ultima 2. And go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what do you think are the best parts of the Ultima 2?
Oh, the Ultima 2 is great. I mean, I think it's a very well-mixed formula of float. It's got good run. It's offered in a number of different weights. The super light's coming in ridiculously right at the FEI limit. It's like mm-hmm. right at 36 and a half ounces.
For a 4 meter.
I mean, I have one, and I mean, the first time I picked it up ready to fly, it felt like an empty standard. And I was like, is there even a battery in this thing? And surprisingly, it penetrates to the wind really, really well. The standard model comes in at about 42 ounces, and then the heavies anywhere between 48 and 54. Mm-hmm. But what's awesome about Ultima is Dennis kind of took a page out of Nan's playbook, where Explorer offered all of these different options in terms of wingspans, different size center sections, which gives you more or less flap if you want to run 3.6, 3.8, or 4.0, kind of a segue into the next section, which is, you know, multiple options in terms of wing joiners and degrees and whatnot. And when you have all of these tools in a single platform, it really gives you the ability to kind of tailor your plane to the conditions and also help suit your flying style.
So speaking of wing joiners, what angle joiners are you using for your Ultima 2?
I love as high of a degree as I can get. So when I was flying Explorers back in the day, I got a hold of these 8-degree wing joiners, and they were really hard to get. And I had a death grip on those things. I'm like, I think I'm winning because I got these 8-degree joiners. And when Ultima first came out, kind of started at about 6 degrees, and then there's 7, 7.5, and now there's 8s. And I gravitate towards the 7.5 to 8 degree joiners. Unless it's a super windy day, then I hold on to those old 6 degree joiners because I want a really flat wing so that when you're turning in that wind, it's not turning your plane into a giant sail and just blowing you further downwind. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking also in the, you know, realm of the Ultima 2s, the Ultima 2 has the V-tail option now as well. And there are more and more F5J models coming out with V-tails. Have you flown the V-tail yet?
I have. I haven't. I mean, I've always been iffy on V-tails. You know, I love the way a V-tail looks. It's super sexy. And it has nothing to do with performance. I'm just a standard cross-tail guy through and through. Now, I have an Ultima 2 V-tail, and I've flown it, and it flies great. My biggest problem with V-tails, and it's always been in competition, if you get in the midair and someone takes your rudder off, you're okay. Someone takes half your elevator off, you're okay. Someone takes off half a V-tail, you're done. And I just, mm-hmm. I've never liked V-tails for competition. I love them for flying personal. Like, I'm looking to get an Agita right now to fly on the slope, just because the Agita is such a sexy model from the Arrow Miller.
Looks are important.
Yeah, it's a good looking plane, and the Ultima looks really, really good as a V-tail as well. And it's mm-hmm. a preference thing. I think people that like V-tails, they think the plane flies better because it has a V-tail. And that little bit of mental juice kind of helps. And, you know, we all have our favorite airplane we go fly, and it doesn't fly any better than our other planes, but we think it does, and we win rounds because of it. And I think that's what a V-tail and a conventional tail are when it comes to this game. If If you love V-tails and you think you fly better V-tails, choose a V-tail. If you like the conventional tails, you know, fly that. And if you like both, get both. It's, I mean, everything's available. But yeah, I've flown both models, and I think they both fly relatively the same. But it really comes down to personal preference.
Interesting, interesting. Because usually people are very diehard, either V-tail, you have to have V-tail, or you have to have crosstail. And there's usually not much middle ground. That's, it's kind of like politics, which we don't get on about in our channel.
I mean, you do want this channel to succeed, right?
I don't want to get shut down by YouTube.
Right.
Now, another option between 5J models is going to be wingspan. You mentioned this about the Ultima and the Explorers as well. There's a lot of wingspans out there for people to choose from. I think most of the 5J models I see are either 3.5 meters, 3.6, 3.8, up to 4, since 4 is the limit. Now, do you always gravitate toward 4, or do you kind of fly different wingspans for different conditions?
I mean, I'm always just giving as much wing as is available, especially when you're low and slow and looking to work that tiny bubble. I want tons of wing area. So I fly 4 meter pretty much all the time. I do have a 3.6 Ultima, and I love the way it flies. It's like flying a DLG that's slightly bigger, and that thing turns on a dime, and then you can stand it on a wingtip and turn. So it comes down to, again, personal preference. I'm battling right now with flying a 3.6 in the wind with really low joiners on a really windy day, because I think you can climb out faster and you have span loading that's a little bit better to get back into the wind. But I haven't flown it enough to say that it's any better than a 4 meter or any worse. So for the time being, this weekend, any contest I go to, you're probably going to see me flying a 4 meter. I just like it better.
Yeah, I think wingspan to me is something that is hard to replace. The kind of performance you can get out of a bigger wing area, a bigger wingspan, especially. If it was me, I'd say 4 meter all the way as well. Well, Toby, you know, it's been incredible chatting with you. Thank you for taking the time to come on to our show again. And everyone, if you enjoyed this episode, please remember to give it a thumbs up and hit subscribe. If you have any questions for Toby, leave some comments down below and we'll try to get to them in a future episode. Thank you, Toby.
Hey, awesome, man. Thanks for having me on the show. Hi, everybody. Hi, Mom.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.